WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The problem of overpopulation has been with us for decades, but the approach to solving the problem is changing. In September, representatives from countries around the world will gather in Cairo for a UN conference on population and development. Under discussion will be a document that was drafted by the participating countries in April, which emphasizes empowering women, promoting gender equality, and improving women's health care. My guest, Adrienne Germain, is a member of the American delegation. She's the vice president of the International Women's Health Coalition in New York and served with the Ford Foundation for 14 years. She says that our approach to overpopulation has been stuck in the 1950s.
In 1950, the world asked itself, is there a problem? And the answer came back, for example, from India, which had already then a very large population and one that was growing very rapidly, that yes, there is a population problem. That was picked up later on, especially by ecologists, environmentalists, biological scientists, who argued in a framework that Malthus had used 100 years before, that in a finite world with a rapidly growing population, we soon would be out of food, out of water, and out of other basic resources. By the 1950s and 60s, it was quite clear that population was growing rapidly, in fact, at an unprecedented rate. And the solution then was decided to be technology, that is to distribute contraceptives to as many of the world's people, in particular women, as possible. So in the 60s and 70s, the emphasis of population programs, and indeed population policy itself, was equated with or said to be exactly equivalent to provision of family planning services. It was a very narrow construct focused on a technological solution. And the paradox of this, of course, is that we were dealing with the most intimate of human relationships, with decisions between two people, away from the eyes and the interference of their governments and even their communities. So what we've come to realize over the last several years, and the reason that the Cairo conference is so pathbreaking, is that there is not a technological fix to the question of rapid population growth.
When you say technological, you mean birth control, sterilization?
Yes. Basically, modern means of contraception, the pill, newer means such as Norplant, which is a hormonal method that's implanted under the woman's skin, the intrauterine device, all of those methods, which are generally available to women in this country, were said to be important for women in other countries as well.
What makes you so certain that this approach doesn't work?
It's not that it doesn't work. It doesn't have deep roots. And I would say there are two or three dimensions to that. First of all, the emphasis in the last 25 years of these programs has been on quantity. How many married women of reproductive age would actually accept an IUD or the pills or a sterilization? There was very little concern about the quality of the service they were offered, whether or not they would continue to use the contraceptive and use it effectively once they had it. While a base was laid, an infrastructure was set up to deliver family planning services, public education campaigns were developed, and so on, there still were real problems and problems that remain today with the quality of the service being offered. Very often, no choice between methods. You go to, if you're a woman in Bangladesh in those days, you might go to a clinic and find out that you had no choice except an IUD in the very early days of their program. Well, now an IUD, or intrauterine device, is not necessarily appropriate for many women. For example, a woman who's not yet had a child probably should not use an IUD. Similarly, a woman who is not absolutely certain that her partner has no other sexual relationships probably should not use an IUD because there's an association with infection and IUD use. So there are many women, in fact, who should not use that particular method. But when programs don't offer women a choice and they are desperate to avoid a pregnancy, then they may end up using a method that's not suited for them. And there are many, many examples of this, which I think the family planning field has become very well aware of. And what's important about the Cairo document is that governments have acknowledged in this draft that we must put at least as much effort into the quality of services as we put into the quantity.
The UN Conference on Population and Development will be held in Cairo. There have already been protests in Cairo where this conference has been denounced as an American and Zionist attempt to dominate the Islamic world. And there have been similar protests in other Islamic countries. What are those protests about?
Up until now, most countries which are considered to be Islamic have supported and family planning programs and even have provided those services to their citizens. There has always been some amount of debate among religious leaders and among various political activists in those countries as to whether or not those programs were appropriate. But what was important and what remains important about those programs and the convictions of those governments, who range all the way from Indonesia through over to Egypt, is a recognition that especially women must have access to family planning and basic health services. That if they don't, they are threatened with very severe health consequences and even death. So I think what we're seeing here is not a surprising debate within the religious communities, across religious groups, and between religious leaders and politicians that has gone on, you know, for decades and will no doubt continue into the future.
I'm sure one of the things that has been very controversial within the agenda for the UN Conference on Population and Development is the subject of abortion, whether abortion should be seen as a legitimate procedure for birth control and population control. The Roman Catholic Church opposes some of the agenda for this conference because of abortion.
Here again, I think what is important to recognize is that somewhere around 180 government delegations will meet in Cairo to debate the final content of this document. There is tremendous diversity across those countries in the laws that restrict abortion or allow it, in the services that are actually provided or absent. We are reaching in Cairo for a language and a framework which will be respectful of that diversity, but as important, will respect and understand and be based on the reality of women's lives. Around the world, annually, there are about 40 to 60 million abortions. There are probably as many as 200,000 deaths due to botched abortion. That means that while we're sitting here having this interview, in 1 hour, 25 to 30 women have died because they did not have access to safe abortion services. Now, that is the reality of women's lives. Probably 10 times that number, 2 million, will be left either infertile or with severe health consequences, chronic pain, for example, due to botched abortions. That's the reality that we're trying to come to grips with here. In the process leading up to the final conference in Cairo, governments did a review language in the document which recognizes that unsafe botched abortions are a major public health problem that need to be addressed by every country.
Does the Cairo document have anything else to say about abortion?
It is dealt with throughout the document, really primarily in one chapter, which is concerned with health. It is raised in a chapter which is specifically focused on reproductive health. Contrary to some reports in the public media, abortion is not promoted as a human right by this document, nor is it promoted as a method of family planning, but rather it is recognized as a health issue. It is recognized that we must do everything we can to ensure that women have access to contraception so that they can avoid unwanted pregnancies. But it is also recognized that contraceptives are not perfect, and sometimes people are not able to use contraceptives, and therefore there will always be some number of unwanted pregnancies.
My guest is Adrienne Germain. She's vice president of the International Women's Health Coalition in New York. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Adrienne Germain, a U.S. delegate to the UN Conference on Population and Development that will be held next month in Cairo. From 1981 to 85, she oversaw Ford Foundation-funded projects in Bangladesh, including women's health clinics. Tell me a little bit about what you saw firsthand that made you think about what fails and what works.
Well, there is one really very striking example, and that is the difference between a typical local-level clinic that a government runs and the typical clinic run by a group that we've supported for some time, the Bangladesh Women's Health Coalition. Now, if you go to a government clinic, very often you will find it is not clean. There is no place to sit down, that is, for the patient or the client. There may be no medicines, or if there are, they're locked away in a cabinet, and the key is somehow not to be found. Too often, when women go to a clinic for service, they'll find that it's not open. By contrast, if you look at the Bangladesh Women's Health Coalition clinic, you will find that it is light and airy with all the windows open so the air can come through. There are clean white curtains in the windows. There is a bench where clients are invited to sit down when they arrive, which in Bangladesh is a sign of respect. If you don't invite someone to sit down, you're not treating a person with respect. So the whole, just the physical appearance of the Bangladesh clinic is very, very different from the government clinic or the typical government clinic. And yet, the Bangladesh Women's Health Coalition clinics are not based on high salaries, fancy equipment, fancy buildings, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, they deliberately have kept their salaries at the level of government workers. They don't have any fancy equipment. In fact, they do have to rely on referring clients with some complicated problems to a local hospital or government health facility. So we're not talking expense here. We're talking about attitudes. We're talking about how staff are supervised.
I believe you started the first study in Bangladesh of sexually transmitted diseases. Make a connection for me between what you learned in the study of sexually transmitted diseases and what your stand is now about the future of population control.
Well, one of the most important changes that needs to occur as we seek to transform family planning programs into reproductive health programs is precisely to include in the package screening and treatment as well as prevention for sexually transmitted diseases. There's a lot of resistance to this idea. It's believed to be complicated and expensive. I am convinced that it is neither complicated nor expensive. There are a number of investments that have to be made so that we can provide these services in very poor settings. We need better diagnostic techniques. We need better therapies and medicines that are easy to take. But what we mostly need is the political will to recognize that the world situation has changed. We have major HIV/AIDS epidemic. We have pandemics of syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia, some of which are already showing resisting to existing antibiotic treatments. We must do something to control the spread of these diseases in the general population. And so far, the AIDS control programs have been most importantly concerned with commercial sex workers, and more recently with their clients. But their clients go home to wives. And it's those wives that we're most concerned about, and whose only real access to services will be the family planning and maternal child health network. They will not go to STD clinics because those are highly stigmatized. I mean, and in any case, they don't really exist in any number in most countries. So we need one of the most central transformations of family planning is to include screening treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV. Well, another very important element here is for the family planning community to give much higher importance to condoms than they ever have in the past. Family planning community has never seen condoms to be a very effective means of contraception, and they've tended to be downplayed, therefore, in family planning services. But again, we must do much more to encourage condom use, to work with men, to take responsibility for their role in the transmission of disease as well as.
Well, how do you propose to do that? I mean, the emphasis on family planning, I think, has largely been on women, working with women to use birth control. How do you plan on getting to more men in the future?
One of the most remarkable things about this, I think, you know, finally, after 20 years of building up our strength, women's voices are being heard. And when they're heard in the corridors of the UN, it means it's men who's hearing them. Because like the parliaments, like the congresses around the world, it's primarily men who sit in those bodies. And the Cairo document has in it an entire section about men's responsibility. So we've made the first step already. Though that language is not contested in the document, we are not going to debate that in Cairo. That is already accepted. What we now have to do is change that language into reality. First of all, we can invest more than we have so far done in vasectomy programs. We can work with couples so that when they decide that sterilization is the choice that they want to make, that they give at least equal consideration to vasectomy as compared to tubal ligation. Vasectomy is safer, cheaper, and simpler than tubal ligation for women, and there's no reason that we can't right the current imbalance. Currently, tubal ligations around the world are 3 to 4 times as many as vasectomies. We can ensure that those programs that do provide vasectomy work with the men to encourage them to continue to use condoms even though they have been sterilized if they have partners other than their wives. And the reason for that is to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. We can invest in contraceptive research to develop more choices for men. Right now, they have, in terms of technology, only 2 choices, vasectomy and condoms.
You're one of the international women's health activists who is now going to head to Cairo for this UN conference. Is it something new that women's health activists are represented at the UN on this issue of population control?
Yes, it is something new. It's brand new. The previous 2 conferences really did not have involvement of women's health advocates. We did it by mobilizing at the grassroots in all of our own countries, putting together political strategies, pressurizing our own governments. We found people who could tell us how the UN system worked. We went to donor agencies and raised money to pay for airfares. And we helped each other to build solidarity across our diverse views and experiences, to get to New York into the halls of the UN and to be present as governments debated this issue.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. I enjoyed it.
Adrienne Germain is a U.S. delegate to the UN Conference on Population and Development, which will be held next month in Cairo.